We want to let you know that this next story contains traumatic details about child rape and sexual abuse. Please take care as you listen. More than 11 million children experience sexual abuse each year in this country, but many of them hold their stories inside for years. Ruth Solorzano was one of those children. Starting when she was 12 years old, her stepfather, Edwin Kusheva, raped and sexually abused her for 7 years. The abuse resulted in Solorzano getting 6 abortions at different abortion clinics across California. Her stepfather would drive her to the clinic each time, coaching her to use a fake name so there was no real record of the abortions. After years of keeping her story a secret, Ruth finally told the police in 2021. A long and arduous investigation finally led to Kusheva being convicted. He was sentenced to 28 years behind bars last July. His conviction came against the backdrop of Roe v. Wade being overturned by the Supreme Court, meaning many kids who are victims of sexual abuse could be forced to take pregnancies to term and give birth. Solorzano's experience is the subject of a new story in the San Francisco Chronicle by race and equity editor Rahim Hosseini. And Ruth Solorzano and Rahim Hosseini are here with me now. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Rahim, you first started following this story almost a year ago in July 2022 when you saw a 3-paragraph press release from the Sacramento County District's Attorney Office describing that Ruth had undergone 6 abortions as an adolescent. It's a really sensitive story to report. Tell me about finding Ruth and convincing her to tell you the depth of detail that she did about what happened to her.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I did much convincing or try to, really. As you said, I saw this very brief news release with very little information, but it contained that bombshell detail you referenced and a date for a sentencing hearing. So I knew I needed to know more. And so I and a photographer went to the sentencing hearing, not really having many expectations. I didn't even really expect the victim in the case to appear or give a statement. I was just hoping to get some more details, but Ruth showed up to give an impact statement virtually, as did some of her family members. And it was incredibly powerful and candid. And that's really what started this process.
Yeah. And that first day, Ruth, when Rahim was in contact with you, was the day that you delivered your victim impact statement at the sentencing of your stepfather. I imagine that day was the culmination of a lifelong journey for you. Can you tell us firstly what you said in court that day?
Yeah, I mean, I prepared the statement, so it was pretty long and written out, about a page and a half. And I just kind of talked a little bit about how the abuse affected me throughout my life and how it kind of just shaped, you know, the following years after it ended. And one of the things I had mentioned, which Rahim had touched on in the story, was how it felt like he was a cancer that I had been dealing with for a very long time and then finally was able to rid myself of that cancer through many, many years of therapy and of, you know, trial and error, I guess. But I went into detail kind of the abuse because I felt like I needed to release myself. I felt like I needed him to know that I was ready to speak up for myself and that he didn't have control over me anymore. And it felt really empowering, honestly, when I was giving the statement.
You know, we're not going to go into detail here with you about the years of the abuse, and we really recommend people read Rahim's story in the San Francisco Chronicle. But I can't imagine what it would have felt like to look at your stepfather in court at the sentencing hearing after all he did to you. And it only happened because of your courage to speak up. He took your childhood in a really vicious way. How hard was that?
Well, I mean, it was it was just, I don't know. It was so crazy. He started making advances of me when I was 11, and it went through for so long. You know, he was grooming me, gaslighting my mom, just had complete control over our family. I mean, we converted to Seventh-day Adventists, which, if you don't know, it's a sect of like Christianity, but they're very strict. So, you know, what I wore was controlled, what I watched, what I listened to for many years. So I was kind of like brainwashed, I guess is a good way to put it. But, you know, when I turned 15 and a half, they allowed me to get a job, which is where him and my mom worked. And he was my boss. And that happened for a while. And then when I turned 16 and a half, 17, I was able to go to school because I was homeschooled from eighth grade through high school. But then when I was 17 and I was like my senior year of high school, I was allowed to take some like advanced classes at the local community college. And the two classes that I took at that time were English and philosophy and ethics. And that philosophy ethics class was a huge eye-opener for me, a huge life-changer for me. I started realizing that there were other ways of thinking. And that kind of like propelled me into just realizing that like what I was going through wasn't normal. And you know, finally, when I graduated high school and, you know, we still worked together at that office. And it was honestly the recession in 2007, I got let go from the company that we all worked at. And that was kind of like a really big release for me because I didn't have to see him anymore because by then him and my mom had gotten divorced. So, you know, we weren't living with him anymore. And then when I got let go, I really didn't have to see him. And so that was like a huge like release. And I was able to go, you know, I went to community college and I met people and I started getting into the theater program. And I just started to, you know, become educated. And honestly, education, I still say to this day, is what saved me.
I mean, I imagine, you know, there's the urge to just move on and build a life and put it all behind you. Mm-hmm. But then at some point, you know, you tell your friends, your close friends, you tell your mom, and then you decide to tell the police. And I'm wondering what led you to that, because only about a third of sexual abuse cases are ever identified and most are never reported to law enforcement. What made you want to come forward?
I mean, the years time. You know, I started therapy when I was 22, I think. I was like 22 years old in college, at university by then. And, you know, the first part was just me trying to let go. And just I felt like I just needed to, the woman worked with me for a while just on realizing that what happened to me wasn't my fault. And that was like a huge, huge journey for me to realize that.
That's so deep, Ruth, if I can just jump in, because, you know, when to read the details in Raheem's story, it's so clear to an outsider that it wasn't your fault, that you were so viciously taken advantage of. How was it the fact that you felt brainwashed that you thought it was your fault?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he made me believe it was me from the very beginning. From the very beginning, he would tell me that I was the one giving him looks at 11. Mm. You know, and so like this is what these people do. Now I know this because I've, you know, done a lot of work, but I know that this is what these people do, you know? They make you believe that you're the one and it's not them, it's you. And so I had that in my mind for so long. And so you just believe that. And then, you know, when I finally got into therapy and started releasing those things from myself, I mean, it took years. I still, like you said, you know, the thing you want to do is you want to be like, okay, I don't have to deal with this. He's not in my life anymore. I don't want to think about it. I'm going to move on. But unfortunately, the reality is that it just nags at you. And no matter what, you do have it in the back of your brain. You know, is he doing this to someone else? Is, you know, like that's the big thing, you know? And honestly, it really wasn't until the pandemic that I had time to kind of reflect in a way where, you know, I didn't have a job at the time. And I was really depressed and I started meditating. It was this chain text message I got from a friend being like, do meditation in 30 days. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try it. And I started meditating and I was meditating on, and it just something popped into me. And I actually created a podcast called Post Ugly. And I interview survivors and mental health professionals about life after abuse. And when I started doing that, it just became so therapeutic. I didn't realize how much I would not only learn, but also just like relate to these other people. And it was just becoming like more and more of a thing that I could actually like talk about freely and not, you know, completely like just go into a crying spell, because you have these other people who've been through similar situations or even worse, or, you know, you're just, and you're also realizing when you're talking to, you know, mental health professionals about these kinds of things, the kinds of patterns that develop and how this is something that is just so common and that just happens to so many people. And it's, and it is like cyclical and it's just like a pattern. And it's unfortunately, and I hate to say this, but unfortunately I realized that I wasn't special in that way. And that made me realize like, oh, and then finally, honestly, it was my brother who I had a conversation with, and I just realized how much it was really affecting him to know, because my brother lives in Sacramento and that's where he was living at the time. And my brother was like, I can't live here knowing that that guy is here. And that was kind of like when I kind of pulled the Band-Aid and I was like, you know what, I'm going to do it. And I did.
And Raheem, you spoke to a number of child sexual abuse experts for your story. Talk a little bit about the cycle of, I guess, isolation, shame that survivors find themselves in that prevents them from doing what Ruth did, which is telling their story.
Well, and I think, yeah, Ruth spoke to it too. And what she sort of discovered doing her podcast, I tried as best as I could to replicate through my reporting and then convey through the story the patterns and pathologies that this abuse takes, where, you know, more than 90% of victims know their abusers, more than a third are related to them. Most survivors wait well into adulthood to tell anyone. If they ever do tell anyone, most survivors don't turn to the police. The ones, the very few who do, mostly don't get a satisfying legal resolution, which is where Ruth's story is maybe unique. So the additional reporting I did in talking to subject experts and authorities on abuse, pediatric health, adolescent trauma, was really so I could understand Ruth's story in its proper context and not approach it in a vacuum. And the more I did that, the more I saw that what Ruth experienced really does replicate, sadly, in abuse after abuse. You know, the way her abuser isolated her, manipulated her and those around her. Each case might have its own specifics, but there is just broad similarities. So where the story goes into detail, and we try to be very restrained with how much detail we used. The point is to show other survivors who might read the story that they are not alone, and to show those around these survivors what to maybe look for.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was so striking, and Ruth, you said it, and Raheem, you said it in the article, is just how shamefully common this is. And I think we can't avoid the fact that you're coming forward and the resolution of your stepfather being found guilty and sentenced comes in a post-Roe world, and that's the world we're in now, where in many states children won't be able to get an abortion. And I'm wondering, Raheem, is that something you raised with Ruth over the course of telling her story?
Again, you know, going back to July 2022, this national moment that we're all still in was inescapable. So, you know, I knew very little about Ruth's story showing up to the sentencing hearing, but I knew that we were in the midst of this enormous reckoning, this enormous reshaping of American culture and rights and healthcare. And, you know, it was, I think, just a few weeks before the sentencing hearing that Ruth spoke at, you know, the news came out of that 10-year-old girl in Ohio who had to travel outside the state to terminate her rape-caused pregnancy. So it was very much in my mind. And then when I showed up, Ruth spoke very directly and powerfully to this moment herself, independently of what I was thinking. And so I knew that it was something that she had been thinking of as well.
Ruth, were you thinking that when you know, all of this was unfolding, which should have been bringing you closure, but now it's coming in this very politicized moment?
I absolutely thought about it. I mean, when, you know, when everything happened with Roe v. Wade, I've actually never released this, but I just did a video of myself, of the reaction that I had, just because I needed to get it out. And I didn't even put it out, but it was just me talking about how, and I touched on this on my victim impact statement, how if I wouldn't have been able to get an abortion, I know that he would have made me, you know, made it look like I committed suicide. I remember when I was a kid, he would tell me things like, what if I threw myself down the stairs so that I could terminate the pregnancy? Mm-hmm. You know, he would say things like that to me. And so, you know, or just like, give me pills to see if the pills would do something. So yeah, I absolutely think that if Roe wasn't a thing, you know, then I would have, things might have turned out really differently.
You know, it's hard to think about the number of children who this will affect right now. And obviously you want to move on, but I wonder if there is a message that you have, you know, that you would like people to understand in the context of your story and the right to get an abortion and what that means for other children going forward.
Oh, wow. A singular message, I don't know, but I know that, you know, as a survivor and as someone who has struggled with something like this for a very, very long time, for basically my entire life, I always felt so alone. I always felt like, you know, shame. We talked about shame, and I was just so ashamed, so much shame. And I just want people out there, kids or, you know, young adults or older adults, I mean, there's survivors at every age, unfortunately. I want them to know that they're not alone, and that if they've, you know, been through something similar, they've had an abortion, if they need one, you know, not to be ashamed to do the right thing for you, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, what these abusers want is they want to have power over you. They want to control you. They want to control your body. They want to control your mind. They want to control everything about you. And, you know, not giving yourself the opportunity to be like, no, I'm going to take that back. You know, you're going to regret that. You know, you want to take your power back. And I absolutely believe, you know, my body, my choice in every aspect. And I want people to know that, like, that's okay. You know, like, there, I feel like there's so many things out there trying to contradict that, trying to take that away from you, and no one has the right to take that away from you.
I would love to end, Ruth, by you telling us how life is now. You're an actress. People may have seen you on in various shows. How are you doing now that this has passed you and you have spoken out and kind of slayed a dragon that was, you know, such a traumatic part of your past?
I'm actually, and you know, I'm not saying this lightly, I'm actually the happiest I've ever been in my life. I can really say that and really mean it. I feel like I finally have been able to just release myself from this, and I feel like a different person, to be honest. You know, I've really worked really, really hard to build this life for myself. And I'm still here, you know, trying to create a community for survivors, you know, trying to get people to realize that, you know, there's help out there and that you can, you know, you can move forward and that this doesn't have to rule your life. And so, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I have a very loving husband who supports me and who we have a great relationship. And I have a career that I've really worked hard on, that I'm still working on. And I have a family that, you know, it's been rough along the years, but like I definitely have the best relationship with my mom I've ever had, which does not come lightly because there was a lot of struggle with that. But both me and my mom are really in really good places together now. And that feels really good. So I don't know. I just want people to know they're not alone. And I just want people to know that, like, I don't know, you can slay the dragon, I guess. Or at least come close to it.
You did.
Thanks.
You did that, Ruth.
Thank you.
Ruth Solorzano, thank you so much for your courage, for telling us your story. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Rahim Hosseini, race and equity editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, who authored the story about Ruth. Thank you, Rahim.
Thank you for having me, and thank you, Ruth, for letting me share your story.
Thanks, Rahim.